people decide ahead of time what they are, who they are, and how they can or cannot move through the world. And as somebody who has spoken in front of thousands of people, from like Fortune 500 companies to tech companies to conferences of all stripes, I know that once people understand that being creative and living and working in a spirit of joy is actually an option that they can start to imagine and try on what it might look like to live and work in a state of joy as opposed to in a state of resistance and fear.
Welcome to the People Stack podcast, where we discuss the intersection of people, work, and technology. I'm your host, Jen Bunk. I am a career coach for tech managers and CEO of the People Stack. My guest for this episode is Tanya Catan. She is a career creativity expert, keynote speaker, and best-selling author of Creative Trespassing. Welcome, Tanya.
Thanks for having me, Jen. I appreciate it.
Oh, the pleasure is all mine, Tanya. I'm really excited to talk. And so first, let's talk about what is creative trespassing and how is it that you help people do this?
Sure. So creative trespassing, it's really, there's no magic. What it is it showing people in the workforce who, you know, function in all different industries and at all different levels, that we don't need to be in a job or a field that is uniquely creative in order to be uniquely creative within our work. That's the primary thrust of creative trespassing.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So for those listeners and for myself, I wouldn't consider myself to be in necessarily a creative field, although if you were to stretch it out, there is some creativity involved in career coaching. but yeah, like the traditional would be, okay, I'm in something in the arts or music or something like that. But yeah, that's very cool. And what about the trespassing piece of it, though? How does that come to play?
Yeah, and first I would like to say also that, you know, a lot of people that are reading the book and that I actually speak in front of when I'm keynoting aren't people who necessarily think of themselves as quote-unquote creative. And so really what the focus and objective of the book and of everything that I do and connect with is for people to access their imagination, because that is really where creativity comes from. So it's not about being an artist specifically or a creative writer. It's about accessing our imagination. And that's helpful whether or not we're, you know, we're in a creative field, if we're just problem solving or we need to be resourceful and or if we need to come up with innovative ideas. So that's key to all of this work. Sure. And so the trespassing part, well, for years people would ask me, you know, what do you do, Tanya, with sort of like a big question mark at the end of it, because a lot of times I was working for companies or organizations in their marketing department, and I was like this wild, weird person who would run around and try to connect with people and be playful and share stories and ideas, and they're like, so what's your job title again? And for years I would do one of two things. One, I would try to come up with the most impressive, you know, things I could think of, like, you know, I am a curator of storytelling, you know, or I am, you know, a this or that. And then I also realized, oh my gosh, maybe when they're asking me what my job title is, maybe they really want to know what I do or what my passion is and how that plays out in a work day. And when I understood that, I'm like, well, I'm creative. That part. And what am I doing with my creativity? Oh, I'm sometimes sneaking it into places and processes where it doesn't seem to belong, and it's definitely not invited. But once that creativity is there, it actually adds levels and layers to the mission or values of the organization. And so I'm like, well, what is that called when we sneak stuff into places where it doesn't belong? And I made a list, you know, and I'm like, well, it's this, it's that, it's trespassing. And I put the two together, creative trespassing, and I'm, yes, this is what I do. And when I started to beta test it out at conferences or, you know, after talks and people are like, what do you do? And I'm like, I'm a creative trespasser. And people 100% of the time were intrigued and excited enough to ask me, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. So it wasn't so esoteric that it took them out of a conversation, like they just wanted to leave. but it was, you know, it was interesting and abstract enough for people to engage in conversation. So that's kind of the inception of the title of creative trespassing.
Yeah, and thinking about what is trespassing, you're not necessarily invited, but you can then add some value afterwards. So it's not about, you know, breaking the law or going outside of the boundaries of what might be acceptable. Well, at least in terms of, you know, getting in trouble or things like that.
Right, right. It's not about getting busted.
Right.
Yeah, and also, I don't know, do you ever hike, Jen?
Yeah.
So I thought about it once like this, like, you know, if I was on a hike and it's a beautiful day and, you know, I'm walking and I have water and snacks and I'm ready to be in nature. And all of a sudden there's a big sign that says no trespassing, mm-hmm. home. You know, do I give up the hike? Do I give up this beautiful day in nature? No, I find a way around the sign. I find a new path. And so to me, the trespassing part is really a proposition of how I can use, you know, creative skills or imagination to come up with a new way through that obstacle or around it or embrace it and have it dissolve in front of me. So I think trespassing is actually nice now. Tough stuff. Well, I'm going to find a new way, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm wondering if you can share, maybe you could pick one of your favorite stories. I know, so I saw you talk at Business of Software last year, and I've heard it in your book. I know that you talk about some of your stories as examples of, you know, what creative trespassing might look like and some of the things that you've done. So can you share, you know, a quick anecdote of some of the things that you've done for organizations that might fall under the category of creative trespassing?
Yeah. So one story that comes to mind is that I was hired at a museum because they wanted a rule-breaking outsider to come in and create new programs, new revenue streams, and new audiences for a new space within the museum. And some of the rules of museums, as you may or may not know, is like, you know, don't drink alcohol in the museum and definitely don't spill alcohol on the floor. And even, you know, if it's contemporary art, sometimes you can touch it, but we'll let you know when you can touch it. And if not, don't. And please be quiet. Don't have conversations. And so they were looking for somebody to enliven a space and, you know, maybe have conversations and performances and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And on my first day at work as the resident rule breaker, you know, my boss introduced me to all my colleagues who were real curators. I was just a knucklehead from the outside brought in with a theater degree. Mm-hmm. And he was like, this is Tanya Catan. We brought her in because she's a rule breaker and we want rule breakers in the museum. And they were, you know, in shock and their faces were, they were like freaking out. And then, you know, he'd introduce me to someone else and he'd say, you know, this is Tanya. She has a degree in theater and we need some drama around here. And, you know, and this is Tanya. She thinks outside of the box and that's what we need inside the museum. Mm-hmm. And then he showed me to my office, which was literally a very, very small cubicle. And I thought, this is ironic or just plain mean. You know, why was I brought in to break the rules and think outside the box and then shoved inside a box?
Okay, you know.
And so at that point, you know, I looked around and I realized, oh, well, cubicles don't have ceilings. So that's some information. And then I'm like, wait, there's no ceilings, there are no limits. What can we do now? And what I learned in theater school was actually, you know, when you're engaged in a live performance, you can't pretend that something's not happening. And so if, for example, I'm performing and a baby cries really loudly and the entire audience is focused on the baby, I can't pretend that's not happening. Mm-hmm. Right. You know, there's no like, commercial break in live theater. There's no editing, right? It's just as is. And so I learned in theater to incorporate what was happening, but within the world that we created on stage. So I thought, well, I work in a cubicle. My job is to break the rules of the museum. How can I make this work to my advantage? And so I created a series called Out of the Cubicle, where I hired a videographer, and we literally snuck out of my cubicle and made videos that were, some of them were poking fun at this art institution that I worked for, and we were also celebrating the fact that, oh my gosh, it's so much fun to work for a museum, and it's also mundane and weird and just as boring as any other job that one encounters. And these videos allowed people who didn't know about the Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art to start to learn about it. And I used humor as a strategy to engage audience members. And they started to think, oh my gosh, this is so funny and weird. You know, she's like hopping around, running for, you know, launching a campaign to win Employee of the Month. What kind of knucklehead is she? You can't win it. You got to earn it. And yet it allowed people to come in, and then they literally came into the museum as a result of this series Out of the Cubicle. They were coming in by the thousands from around the world via the videos, and then the ones who lived in Arizona were coming in, or the ones who were on vacation came into the museum to see what kind of events we were actually doing in real time and space that were similar and reflected the same spirit of the online series.
That's very cool. That's very cool.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, when you did this Out of the Cubicle series, was it with the intent of it being a piece of marketing to get more people to come to the museum? Or was this, okay, I am the resident rule breaker. What can we do to sort of liven it up here and potentially get, you know, people more excited about the museum?
Yeah, both. So I definitely had a consciousness that I was hired to bring more people into the museum. Mm-hmm. But how I got there was up to me, quite frankly. And I come from performance. I know how to engage an audience and listen and respond in real time to what the needs of an audience are. Is and are. And so, I consciously said, well, how can I playfully engage my colleagues, get to know them, and also show people who maybe felt like museums were, you know, sterile or uninviting, or maybe weren't seeing them as a potential audience. How can I show people who are outsiders just like me that you're actually invited inside, and we want you to come in, mm-hmm. and see what's cooking, and we actually have programs and installations for you. So, you know, both my marketing brain and my playful theatrical side consciously merged to make these programs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. And so I want to talk about rule breaking a little bit more. And so as we talked about in the beginning, we're not talking about like trying to get, you know, arrested or anything like that, or maybe even just referring to as breaking norms. Like there's norms within a museum, for example. So you had to go in and kind of go outside of that and go outside of the literal box. And so what would you say to people, and I'll admit that the reason that I'm asking this question is that I am one of them, is that I absolutely get that the creativity, that it's going to shine when we go outside of those normal rules and those norms. But I'm kind of afraid to do that. You know, it doesn't feel right. I'm afraid. I'm not sure what's going to happen. What would be your response to that?
Well, okay. Well, first of all, we get into this weird mindset that we've been trained from years of schooling and years of, you know, government influence and years of our parents, you know, telling us these are the rules, follow them. However, if you look up the definition of what rules are, they're basically just operating principles. Okay. So, you know, if rules help us operate, awesome. But if they are not helping us operate, it's our job as human beings, as creative trespassers, to reimagine the rules, you know. And I can think of rules on a very basic level. You know, I think about there's an unspoken rule within work culture, especially don't share your salary. Right? Mm-hmm. That might actually help you negotiate, you know, like don't, and this is something I've learned actually by speaking at a lot of conferences and summits that are focused on empowering women in the workforce, especially in terms of financial and economic equity. Mm-hmm. It's women have not shared our salaries with each other, and men haven't shared their salaries with us. So we don't know. And then at some point, somebody will find out, oh my gosh, I've been working in this position for 10 years, and a guy who just came in is making more than I am in the same position. So mm-hmm. that's a rule that we've been taught, or it's an unspoken rule sometimes. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's not necessarily helping us operate. So it's an opportunity to question it. There's a rule also that we have to have to-do lists. We have to have an agenda. Why? Why can't we have a to-don't list? You know, why can't we have, you know, a list that is actually all the stuff that we do on a daily basis to derail our dreams, to derail our purpose, to actually that stops us from moving forward in our career and in our work. Mm-hmm. And so these are rules, again, if we go back to a foundation of a rule is something that helps us operate as individuals, as collaborators, and as companies, and it is no longer serving the purpose of us operating or moving forward in a generative way. It's our job to break those rules.
Yeah. That you're absolutely speaking my language there, especially in terms of thinking about rules as operating principles that serve us. And if they don't serve us, then let's reimagine the rules. But also the don't share your salary unspoken rule. As a career coach, I talk about salary quite a bit. One of the ways that I introduce myself when people wonder what it is that I do, I say I help tech managers command premium salaries of at least 200K a year without working their butts off 50 plus hours a week. And so I was actually a little bit scared in the beginning to talk about it that way because of this unspoken rule of we don't talk about how much we make. You know, I was brought up in a family where we don't talk about money, and certainly you never ask anybody else how much money do you make. And yet here I am as a career coach asking people, how much do you make? What's your target salary? And it really does kind of, it opens it up not only to conversations about, like you said, financial economic equity, but also just kind of owning your worth and wow, maybe I could be making more. And how can I do that? And what would that look like? So that's awesome. And then the to don't list, imagine if we were to start our day with that. And that might actually give us the freedom to just sort of like brush all that aside and be like, okay, what's important? What's important? Mm-hmm. If all of this is a to don't, what do we do?
Yep. That's exact. And in fact, the to don't list is one of the exercises in my book. And I walk through what to do with our to do list. So there's definitely, strategies, because I've lived it myself in terms of questioning my value in the context of a job and also my skill set, and ultimately realizing that, you know, my unique skills, the skills that I thought I needed to leave outside of work for the weekends, were actually even more valuable to the companies that I worked for and to myself. And once I started to understand that, you know, then I started to feel more comfortable asking for what I'm worth in terms of a salary. So I think it's awesome that you lead with that for the people that you work with, because once we understand that it's not about sort of a Tinder way of matching our skills or our values to what the company values, but it's actually looking at the company's values, and you realize, oh wait, they champion diversity, they embrace creativity. Yes. Maybe all the stuff I left off my resume will actually help me command a higher salary and value myself more within that context. Right. And that's why I thought Creative Trust Testing was really important too, because, you know, I've literally had thousands of people talk to me, you know, either after I'm speaking or after I'm consulting or working with companies, and it's almost like they're shy and confiding in me, like, you know, I have a degree in theater too, you know, or I paint on the weekends. And I realized that there was a big disconnect between who we are and what we do, or our creativity or imagination reserved for the weekends and what we do during the week. And I thought, oh my gosh, we need to bridge this gap. And that was really actually the impetus for me writing the entire book.
Yeah, I can absolutely feel that. And I can relate to that idea. I want to talk about this idea of weekend skills, the weekend me versus the weekday me, because I feel like as I've become more fulfilled in my life, the weekend Jen is more like the weekday. There's no difference, right?
Yep.
And it's almost intangible in some ways, but I know that a part of it is kind of tapping into that playfulness and that creativity and sort of like, oh, wow, is this supposed to be fun? Oh, boy. Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah, right. Like, work is supposed to be hard, isn't it? But you know what? When it is fun, that's actually when we're able to add more value. And it really does come back to something that you said earlier, Tanya, at least I believe this is a huge piece of it, is accessing our imaginations. I'm wondering if you could actually talk about that a little bit more, but, you know, by way of, you know, this whole weekend me and I'm fun and I'm playful and I can imagine.
Yeah.
But I guess I know. How, like, because yeah. I'm someone who's, you know, I used to say I have a terrible imagination, you know, and I've kind of broken out of that. I've totally squashed that self-limiting belief, but I still find it kind of tricky sometimes. So how do you suggest for people like to be playful? How do we access our imaginations better?
Realize I can choose freedom. I can choose to bring in my creativity to work. So I'll get to the how in 1 second. Yep. But when I was at my museum job, you know, running around like a crazy person, the board of directors, it was a large corporately structured museum, and the board of directors were concerned. My colleagues were concerned. Concerned citizens were concerned. And they all went to my boss, and they wrote letters and emails and all these things. And they said, basically, Tanya isn't working. She's just running around having fun. And I'm like, and I was confronted. The good news was my boss had my back. My immediate colleagues in the museum had my back. And what I realized really quickly is A, work and joy are not mutually exclusive at all. And B, you know, when we are choosing to work in a state of joy, that can be very confrontational to people who are choosing, whether unconsciously or consciously, not to. And so what happens a lot of times, you know, and what's scary is we bring ourselves to work, we bring our creativity to work, and then people roll their eyes. People say, she's not working. You know, people respond proportionately to the amount of joy and creativity we bring to work. And that can be scary, right? Yeah. So we try it out one time, you know, and then people don't respond favorably. And we're like, note to self, never doing that again. Again, mm-hmm. I will just follow the rules and stay stuck and bide my time until my paycheck comes.
Yeah.
And so that's an outcome that's very real. And in the face of that, I say continue to practice, to continue to try, because it gets easier when we do bring our creativity and it is serving the greater good of the company, the mission of the company, and the values. It gets easier for us when people are responding negatively to go, oh, that's not about me. I'm actually bringing value to my job and to my colleagues and to the company. Yeah. And so that's not my issue, actually. And I'm actually even more productive because I'm bringing more of me into the day-to-day. And so how you do this is twofold. One, some people literally work in situations where they're like, it is so rigid. I have golden handcuffs on. I cannot do anything creative. Tanya, I don't even know what you're talking about. This isn't for me, right? Mm-hmm. And to those people, I say, fine, then you better be practicing your creativity on the weekends, in the mornings, and in the evenings. Yeah. Because what happens is a lot of times, you know, there are a ton of people who are like, I want to write a screenplay. I want to write a book. I want to paint. And they don't do it. And then they're also unhappy in their rigid workplace. When you are doing that, you cannot help, like you were saying, that thought process of generating a painting, of writing a screenplay, that will seep into the work you do, no matter how rigid it is, and it will feed it, and vice versa. So if you are practicing your creativity, even on the weekends or, you know, during the week in the mornings, I used to write plays and even an entire book before this book at 5 o'clock in the morning from 5 to 8:30 a.m. I would do my creative stuff, and then I would go into jobs that were less creative. And because I was doing the work that enlivened me, it allowed me to feel okay about what I was doing from 9 to 5. Mm-hmm. And some of that seeped in as well. And then, you know, sometimes you're in your work and you think it's like, oh, this is so not creative. I wish I was having a little more fun. You can disrupt those patterns and habits by engaging in play and in creativity. So for example, you might send an email to your team, you have a 10-minute break coming to you anyway, send an email and say, in 10 minutes, we're taking a creative break. And this theme is writing. So somebody comes up with a prompt. The writing prompt today is writing about your mother's hands. Go. We're writing for 10 minutes. And then you just write. That's it. You could choose to share what you wrote or not. It doesn't matter. But just by disrupting the pattern of staying in front of your computer and typing language into a keyboard and using that as a tool that is kind of rigid, you're disrupting it. You're writing with a pen or a pencil on a piece of paper. The prompt is something creative. It has nothing to do with, you know, with finishing up Q4 goals. Mm-hmm. And it will allow your brain to form new neural pathways that help you get back in and problem solve or tackle your Q4 goals in a new way. So, yeah. You can... Yeah,
I love the write about your mother's hands. Anything doesn't matter as long as it's not anything to do with work. Because I think we often okay, I want to be creative. I want to sit down and write. What am I going to write about? Oh my goodness, I need to decide what it is I'm going to write about.
That's right. And you get stuck in like thinking about how do I access this? And also moving it around, letting you know. So it could be a 10-minute dance break, and the team that comes for the dance party, each week they come. A new person comes up with the theme. So it's like, okay, the theme for this week's dance party is hip hop. Let's go. 10 minutes, go. They come with the music. So it also empowers people to come up with the ideas. And when people have like a week to prepare, they're like, I came up with hip hop. I have the best music possible. It empowers them to lead. This is something else, you know. We have a really rigid way of thinking about the rules of leadership within the work context. It's like, you have to be in order to lead, right? You have to have it in your title somewhere. No, you don't.
No, right.
No, you don't. You can empower people to lead that creative workshop or idea.
Yeah.
And people love it. And so it's actually giving an opportunity to lead to people who may not have that opportunity more formally.
Absolutely. So we have some great examples here. Write, dance. What might be some other verbs we can add there? That would be a way of, you know,
draw.
Accessing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Walk. Walk is actually the big one. There was actually, I am on the board of the Museum of Walking. You will have to look it up because it's just as weird and amazing as it sounds. But it's been proven. There was a Stanford study on walking and creativity that literally the act, if you find yourself stuck in terms of, you know, solving a problem or just in an idea that you need to incubate, get up, leave your desk, and go for a walk. So in this study, it was proven to increase your creativity by 60%. That is not shabby.
Wow.
So walk, go for a walk. And in fact, in the book, I had the great privilege of speaking with an artist named Angela Ellsworth, who's also the director of the Museum of Walking. And she gives her students every semester on the first day they come in, right? And you know, they're all outfitted up with like all of their technology and bags and things like this. She's like, yeah, okay, so everybody ditch your cell phones, your iPads, your computers, your bags, everything. And your assignment is to leave the classroom and wander for an hour and a half with no agenda. And they panic. And literally every time she engages her students in this activity, there's at least one who's like, this is really scary. What if something happens to me? What if I get into, you know, like a car hits me or I fall down on the pavement or, you know, and I don't have my cell phone. And she's like, yeah. She's like, you know what? There was a time not that long ago when none of us had cell phones. And look, we're all alive.
Yes. Look at that.
And, yeah. And a lot of the students are literally resistant to this exercise, but they have to do it. So they go. And they come back every single time totally transformed. You know, and they say things like, oh, my gosh, I didn't realize because I wasn't glued to my phone, because I wasn't, you know, texting or talking, I had to look up. And I realized that this parking structure that I thought of as a barrier for me to get from here to class if you climb to the top of it, you can see the entire city of Tempe, right? Yeah. So they started, and this one student was like, and you know, on a hot day of wandering, I realized that this tree I'd never noticed before provides the best shade ever. And so they started to have these seemingly magical experiences, but really they were just asked to walk and to wander and to look. You know, that was it.
So,
and it really changed their lives.
It's simple. It's powerful. I'm going to have my clients do this. So note to any of my clients that are listening, if I ask you to wander for 90 minutes, now you know where I came from. That is so powerful. Yeah. And I will challenge myself to do that every once in a while, although I admit it's hard. Like, I live in a city, so it's very easy to just go outside, especially when it's nice out, but, you know, throw a coat on. But, you know, and to just wander, like, it's very hard for me. Okay, where am I going? Okay, I'm going to go to the store, and then I'm going to go here without
It's my every single idea I have ever generated for a client has come from walking, from wandering. Okay. And what I'll do is I'll carry a pad of paper and a pen, and I'll just wander. And ideas will come. And then actually I add a mantra to the mix. Sometimes if I'm really focused on like coming up with a brand campaign for a company, I'll say, the answers are all around me. The answers are all around me. And literally I will look and there's a sign and it says the thing. And I'm like, how is that like a sign there? I didn't realize, you know, or there'll be like a painting on the side of a building. And I'm like, this is the campaign unfolding right before me every single time. Mm-hmm. It is the cure to any kind of creative block.
I love it.
And you know what, Jen? It's also a practice. And this is something we forget. You know, we try to bring our creativity into work. People are like, you suck. And then you never do it again. You know, but if you practice, just like anything else, I mean, you know, lawyers practice law, medical professionals, doctors practice medicine, sports figures, you know, they practice. Theater practitioners, we practice. We have rehearsals. So the more you practice opening your door and going for a 10-minute walk that you're just wandering, the more it will become, your body will know what to do without your mind effing it up. And so anyway, I'm just saying.
Yeah. I absolutely hear that. Hi, everyone. We'll get back to the interview in a jiffy. But first, are you a tech manager? In other words, do you lead teams of geeks through long-term complex projects? Do you feel like you're wasting precious time going to useless meetings, dealing with administrative nonsense, and working late nights? Are you working 50 plus hours a week, but don't have the salary to show for it? It doesn't need to be that way. You can build thriving, high-performing teams who produce a measurable positive impact while earning the premium salary you deserve. Oh. And you don't have to work your butt off to get there. If this sounds like the kind of success you're striving for, then go to jenbunk.com/webinar to reserve a spot in my free masterclass. I share the 4 shifts that my tech manager clients made to achieve badass career transformation. That's jenbunk.com/webinar. Without further ado, please enjoy the rest of the interview. And that's it. And that's a really nice segue to what I was going to ask you next, Tanya, which is about daily rituals. So I'm wondering if you have anything that might resemble daily rituals. With this talk about practice and mantras, I'm wondering, you know, if there's something that you do every morning or evening to make sure that you stay tapped into this creative energy.
Yeah. So a few things. One, walking is my daily practice. It's not only a practice that helps me feel good inside my body, but it allows me to see what's happening in the world around me. And as somebody, I travel a lot for speaking, and sometimes I'll only have a few hours or maybe a day in a city. And, you know, this is the funniest thing. Like, I'll look in advance at the weather, right? And they'll say, New York, it's going to be rainy today. But it's always different when you're on the ground. You know, somehow it's not raining. The weather was wrong. The weather forecast on my computer was wrong. along. And I think that that's actually a metaphor for everything that happens on the ground, that it's always different than we've been taught. Then, you know, I've walked in places. I remember being in Scotland once in Glasgow, and we went for a big walk as part of Museum of Walking. And we came back from this walk, and it was the most amazing walk ever. And people were like, "Where'd you walk?" And we're like, "We went here, we went there." And they're like, "Oh, you could have been killed." You know, I'm like, "Oh, I'm so glad you didn't tell me that ahead of time." Because, you know, again, it's like people have these predictions or ways in which we should move through the world. But when we don't know that, when we scrap that, a lot of times there's magic in those places. So that's part of my practice is walking. And also, you know, I have a meditation group that I'm a part of, and I'm a big fan of reading and learning from teachers who also have practices in terms of meditation and being in the world in a de-siloed way, in understanding that we are connected with everything that we do, with, you know, with nature, with architecture, with the world. So that's really important to me as well.
Got it. Thank you for sharing that. It's been so wonderful talking with you. I have one more question left, and this is, you know, in the 5-10 minutes that we have left to chat, I want to get this question in. It's a question that I ask all of my podcast guests. I can't wait to hear how you respond to it. And that question is, what is the biggest people-related challenge in your job?
Oh, I think that the biggest people-related challenge is the notion of resistance. And I say notion because, you know, we were talking a little bit earlier about self-limiting beliefs. And, you know, I think that people decide ahead of time what they are, who they are, and how they can or cannot move through the world. And as somebody who has spoken in front of thousands of people, from like Fortune 500 companies to tech companies to conferences of all stripes, I know that once people understand that being creative and living and working in a spirit of joy is actually an option, that they can start to imagine and try on what it might look like to live and work in a state of joy as opposed to in a state of resistance and fear. So that's something I love. I love the challenge of interacting with people and processes and companies who are resistant. It's my favorite thing because I experience resistance too. And I've also worked in companies where I'm like, I'm not going to do that. Or I blame them for my lack of creativity. Like, they don't pay me enough to be creative. Why should I do that? And when I started to see, you know, that there were other ways of being in the world and in my work, I was like, not only am I more generative, in my body, but I'm more generative with my colleagues and with companies when I choose joy over fear and resistance. So I guess that's my people-related challenge. And as a person, it's a challenge I also, you know, confront too. So,
yeah. Yeah, and I wonder if you can give some examples either from yourself or from people who you've interacted with, what this resistance might look like, how it might show up for people who might, I get it, you know, who might say, I get that theoretically, I get that at a high level, but I'm not really sure, I must be resisting something, but what could that be to kind of open it up a little bit? What are some of the things that people might be resisting, perhaps without even being aware of it?
Well, I think that there's certain, so I want to go back to a little bit to limiting beliefs, because I think that that's where some of the resistance starts, with these beliefs that we hold or that we've actually developed that are obstacles for us, we put in our own way from us achieving whatever we want to achieve. And so, you know, in interviewing a lot of people and also in coaching and consulting, there are kind of like a greatest hits of self-limits. You know, one is, I don't deserve. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and that can be, oh my gosh, people have shared with me, I don't deserve to be happy, that's one of the beliefs that they've held, or I don't deserve a raise. And another limiting belief is I don't belong here. So it's imposter syndrome. Another is I'm not confident enough to apply for the job, ask for a raise, call myself an artist, etc. And so those to me are all, you know, you're resisting before you even have a chance to explore, right? This idea of I don't deserve, well, then you've stopped yourself from starting. And so on a really basic level, it's, you know, actually self-limiting beliefs, I think, are wonderful because there are clear ways for us to say, oh, I made this thing up. Let me look at this thing. Let me turn it around. Let me see what if this limit was actually an opportunity to have unlimited, you know, options. So for example, if my self-limiting belief is I don't belong here, which is actually one of my self-limiting beliefs, sometimes I'll be speaking in front of, you know, like thousands of leaders in technology. And it's like, I have a degree in theater. I don't know anything about AI or IA or VR, you know, what am I doing here? I don't belong here. And then I'll realize, oh, but if I don't belong here, then I belong there, and I belong there, and I belong everywhere. So maybe in me feeling like I don't belong and exploring what that means, I can find that I do belong here. And I can also find, like, well, then why did they invite me here? Oh, they invited me because I don't belong here, because I have a different set of skills that actually add to what they're doing. And they want some of that secret sauce. And, you know, and conversely, I can learn from technology. So I think that actually exploring these areas that we've created that stop us, and finding out how they can actually be an opportunity to start believing and start pursuing what we want to be doing, they can actually be a really rich space.
Yeah. And I love you. You just gave a really beautiful example of there of how we kind of get out of our own self-limiting beliefs of by kind of creating doubt around it and sort of coming up with the examples for why exactly I belong here, you know, just playing with the notion that maybe the opposite is true, right?
Yep,
so taking
absolutely.
Whatever that is, I don't belong here. All right, what's the opposite? Just play with, you know, just sort of play with it, be open with it. Okay, the opposite's true. I absolutely belong here. This is the exact place for me. If I had to come up with some examples, this is how I like to play with it, because it kind of does get the problem-solving part of the brain involved in it as well. What's the evidence? If I had to find some evidence that I absolutely belong here, what would that be? Well, they invited me here. So, okay, there's one piece of evidence. And then you kind of stack on top of it and say, oh, shoot, you know, I could choose to believe this if I wanted to. I could choose that this is the right place. It's such a fun exercise, actually, once you get used to it. And you can really take a hard look in the mirror and say, wow, what are those other beliefs that I can change too?
Absolutely. And also to that effect, you know, there's an exercise that I talk about in the book. I call it the IROC files, based on the Rockford files, just because I'm a child of the 80s. But anyway, the point is in terms of the evidence that you're talking about, a lot of times we get mired in, you know, I don't want to toot my own horn and I shouldn't celebrate who I am. And so that's fine. Why don't you gather evidence from outside of yourself? So it can be, you know, when testimonials from clients that you've worked with. It can be thank you notes from colleagues or clients or whatever. Any evidence or indication that you've done a job well done, and put that in a file, in a physical file, in an online file. And whenever you're feeling like, I don't belong here, go to the file and look at it, and you will see objective reasons why you do belong, why you are valuable. And so, I mean, this is something I used with clients to address imposter syndrome, because, you know, and as you probably work with, you know, we work with people who have imposter syndrome are actually those who are overachievers, who actually have done more, who care more than anybody else, and they feel like they are not enough. And so it's like, fine, then look to people outside of you to give you the information to show you that you are enough, that you do belong. So
Yeah, I rock. I was wondering. First, yeah. I was thinking, I rock. I little I, big R. What is this? I rock. Yeah. I rock. I rock the world.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's very totally. Cool. That's very cool. Right, and it does kind of build. Okay, I can gather all of this evidence, and it's almost like giving people permission to do this. Permission to celebrate in a way that doesn't feel icky or slimy and self-serving.
Exactly.
Oh, hey, look at this is cool. I have been doing these cool things. So
that's right.
That's great.
Yeah. And it, you know what, actually it serves as another purpose. I just realized too, especially when you're gathering information from clients, you know, a lot of times we work in companies or organizations that don't value us, that aren't seeing our value. And sometimes we need to continue working in those situations for at least a little bit. And so I say, go to the people who you're serving. So it might not be your colleagues or your boss. It might be your audience. It might be your clients. And when you have proof, it's a reminder of why you do what you do. A lot of times we forget and we're like, my boss gave me a crappy review. Well, who are you doing your job for? Yeah, maybe your boss-ish, but you're also serving an entire community of people. You know, sometimes we call them clients. Sometimes we call them communities. Sometimes we call them audiences. And get their feedback. That's valuable.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Such a wonderful, wonderful point, Sonia. Well, we are just about up on time, and I believe that the conversation has come to a somewhat of a natural conclusion. We have covered so many wonderful topics, and I want to thank you again for spending some time to chat with me today. It's been really fun, really fun chatting
with you. For me too. Thank you, Jen. This is awesome. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah. Great to have you here. All right. So that was Tanya Catan, folks. She's a career creativity expert keynote speaker, and you can check out her book, Creative Trespassing.